I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Novel.
Before we begin, a content warning. The following episode contains difficult themes and violence. The 14th floor of the Woolworth building is always full of people. All those men in suits speaking in important, loud voices, the ringing rotary phones, heavy enough to be weapons, secretaries typing, the ping of typewriters competing with elevator dings and file cabinet slams. It's the usual office racket. But today there's even more chaos than usual. Over 80 women, nearly all sex workers, crowd the space. Curses, threats, prayers, and appeals rise above the usual office hum. And perhaps even more unnerving, some women remain stone silent. Eunice Hunton Carter, once set off in a distant office away from all the action, stands near a woman seated in a circle of a few hovering prosecutors. These men are trying to get her to talk.
You can tell us something about Charlie Lucky, right, sweetheart? You can tell us about Charlie.
These women are being held, and Thomas Dewey's investigation into organized crime's move into sex work. They've been kept for weeks, cut off from all outside contact. Thomas Dewey, Eunice Carter, and the whole team are working round the clock, interviewing, interrogating, good cop, bad cop. They've got to get the women to crack before the gangsters can slip through their fingers. And in the hot seat right now, Nancy Presser.
There's good reasons why people run away from small towns to come to the big city with men they shouldn't trust. And Nancy was one of those. You start as somebody's mistress when you're young and fresh-looking and new to the city. We'll have a good time. I'll put you up in an apartment. And then when he dumps you, you find you don't have a lot of resources. You're not going to go back to your small town.
When Nancy Presser ran away from her home in upstate New York, she got caught up in the seedier side of the Big Apple. By 1936, she was working at a brothel and addicted to opium.
A drug that by the 1930s is used by high-class drug addicts, really high-end drug addicts, because it's considered exotic, and it's used by hardened criminals, especially if they've got enough money.
Nancy Presser's new boyfriend had enough money. Ralph LaGuori was also married and a mafia strongman. He was a member of the Mott Street Boys. Ralph had dropped out of school at age 15 and worked as a Brooklyn butcher until he found his calling in the underworld. I can't imagine what skills he brought to the table.
Ralph LaGuori's name was Ralph the Pimp LaGuori.
At first, Nancy worked solo as a call girl. The mafia doesn't really like call girls. They're too independent. That is, harder to intimidate. But Nancy gives up call girl work and installs herself in a brothel house. And now, she's caught up in the grand sweep of Eunice and Dewey's raid. She's been plucked out of work in the middle of the night. She's sleep-deprived. She's confused and worried. And she's being asked questions about Lucky Luciano. And on top of all that, powerful withdrawal symptoms are kicking in.
All of these women were, of course, terrified. They knew very well the code of the underworld is squealers don't last. Confess to the authorities, you are very likely to end up in the river.
Dewey and Eunice are after a much bigger fish than Nancy Presser and Ralph the Pimp Liguori. They want info on Charlie Lucky Luciano. So they apply more pressure. They threaten Nancy with possession of a firearm.
Nancy Presser was the girlfriend of a booker. So when she was pinched, she was carrying his gun in her purse so that her boyfriend couldn't be pinched for it.
Putting aside the whole snitches get stitches thing, now Nancy has a real reason to talk. She could be facing a possession charge, which could lead to the best part of a decade behind bars. Nancy slowly realizes that nobody is going to show up to bail her out. Not Ralph the Pimp, and certainly not Lucky Luciano.
They had been left to rot in jail, even though they'd been regularly paying their $10 every week.
Nancy has no idea why this is all happening. All she knows is that she's been left alone. What's the point of paying for protection or even having a mob boyfriend if she's being hung out to dry? Eunice and Dewey have Nancy Presser exactly where they want her. Vulnerable, desperate, and trapped. And when she finally does crack, what she has to say surprises even them.
Nancy Presser claimed to be a girlfriend of Lucky Luciano.
Not Ralph the Pimp. Lucky Luciano. The big man himself. Nancy tells her interrogators, not only is she Lucky's girlfriend, she's heard him talk about his involvement in Vice with her own ears. This is how Eunice and Dewey make their breakthroughs, in tracking down witnesses who could link Charles Lucky Luciano directly to prostitution. And if Dewey and Eunice are concerned with the inconsistencies like those in Nancy's stories or in any of the witnesses' reports, the historical record doesn't show it. All it takes is one domino to fall before they all do. After Nancy breaks down, other women do too. Often sick from withdrawal, desperate for help, they begin cracking under pressure. And sitting there with them, writing down every word in meticulous detail, Eunice Hunton Carter. From the teams at iHeartRadio and Novel, I'm Nicole Perkins, and this is The Godmother. Episode 6, Trial of the Century. May 11th, 1936. It's a suspiciously mild day after a sudden scorcher. It's the kind of day where you need only the lightest of jackets, and then the sun warms you and all is right in the world. A good day for a lover's picnic, or to push a child in a swing at the park. But not everyone will get to have the sun on their skin today. Lucky Luciano paces in a jail cell. Thomas Dewey is probably warming up his voice as he has breakfast, preparing for the performance of a lifetime. And Eunice, in the pages of recorded history, on May 11th, 1936, she is nowhere to be found. But she has to be thinking about one building. Opposite Foley Square in Manhattan, the courthouse. After months of painstaking work, today is the day Lucky Luciano faces court. By 10 a.m., members of the press have all filed inside the Manhattan courthouse and taken their seats.
In fact, there were no spectators allowed in the courtroom except the press. The newspapers covered this case assiduously, and they published multiple editions every day.
In the lead up to the trial, Dewey keeps reporters and editors close.
In daily statements to the Daily News and the New York Mirror and the Post and all the rags that were being read every day in New York City.
He preps the news carefully. After Dutch Schultz had died, Dewey's message was focused on Lucky being America's most dangerous criminal. And as the trial of the century approached, he has honed that message more fully. Now, inside the courtroom, all the press turn their heads in unison.
Lucky Luciano is shuffled in with 9 other defendants.
3 of the 12 originally charged with Lucky have pled out. So now, as they enter the courtroom, it's down to Lucky and 9 others, none of whom are wearing handcuffs or a jumpsuit.
In the 1930s, in that New York courtroom, everyone was dressed to the nines. 2 or 3-piece suits, ties, dress shoes, hair neatly done. There was an elegance to it in a weird way. There was a respectability, even though if you were there and one of the defendants, you would have found almost nothing respectable about it.
Appearance matters, especially in front of a jury. But as the eyes of the courtroom focus in on those 9 defendants, it's clear that some of them aren't as refined as their threats.
Nobody seems to have the noticeable demeanor of Luciano. Luciano's co-defendants look like a mishmash of would-be thugs.
Especially those defendants who are used to doing their dirty work in the shadows.
That is exactly what the prosecution wanted.
Judge Philip McCook looms over the courtroom, imperious and intimidating.
He was selected expressly for the purpose of prosecuting organized crime and its corrupting influence on New York politics. Many said that McCook actually acted more as a co-prosecutor than as a neutral judge in the case.
Just as Judge McCook has been specifically chosen, so has the jury.
It was a special jury called a Blue Ribbon Jury of experienced jurors.
All 12 white men sit facing the room.
Jurors who'd previously served and presumably who'd previously voted to convict. So it was a bit of a stacked deck from the beginning against Luciano.
But the defendants didn't just have their lawyers backing them up in court. It's the mob. One hand washes the other, and their colleagues in crime have done their own trial prep.
The mob was behind the defense as much as the attorneys were. There was an incident where someone was caught trying to bribe a juror, and then one juror was kicked off and an alternate put on. So there was a lot going on.
With at least one juror caught taking a bribe, Dewey must have been wondering, who else had the mob approached? Who else have they attempted to buy off? In this corrupt city, who the hell knows? You get past all the obstacles of finding a pattern, rounding up witnesses, getting them to crack, finding the big boss and arresting him. And now, you've got to worry about jury tampering. The path to justice is never smooth. So, despite a favorable judge and jury, no one could predict how events would unfold. And Lucky, he is not giving anything away.
Luciano's facial expression most of the time is complete stoicism.
He's not going to let anyone in that courtroom see any signs of weakness. But
in his head, he is still trying to figure out, how the hell am I on trial with 9 guys I don't know for vice? He's visibly not pleased, although he tries to be stoic. He does not like Dewey. He does not like that this trial has happened. Lucky knows he is a criminal, knows he has good lawyers, but he knows they're going to bring up his criminal history, and he almost seems prepared to handle that.
As Lucky sits there in his tailored suit, resting bitch face firmly in place, he has to have been wondering how it had come to this and who was responsible. If it were me, I'd definitely be looking for someone to take my frustrations out on. But if he did scan the room for faces to glare at, he would not have spotted the woman who'd brought him there.
Eunice Carter was not given the opportunity to try the case.
She was not in the courtroom, no. Dewey had 20 assistant prosecutors. Only about 5 or 6 of them actually participated in the trial itself.
Whether it was because she was a woman, whether it was because she was Black, whether it was because it was both of those things, this is certainly my opinion, but there's no way to look at it other than that it was a calculated and discriminatory decision not to allow her to try the case.
If Eunice had wanted to attend the trial, she may have been permitted, but not as a participant. She would not have been given the chance to sit alongside Dewey. Eunice would have had to watch with the crowds, from the audience. Maybe this is all out of an abundance of caution for her own safety. But it's such a common story for many Black women in the workplace. Your contribution isn't valued until a man co-signs it. And when it becomes the key element to success, you're left out of seeing it through. You're supposed to be content with a thumbs up while someone else leaves his fingerprints all over your work. With or without her, the trial Eunice had helped orchestrate was now in motion. Judge Philip McCook addresses the packed room to read out the charges against the defendants.
90 counts of compulsory prostitution.
Compulsory prostitution. What even was that?
Compulsory prostitution ends up being designed as a charge to try to rope in all the people around the women who are doing the work. So it is really a catch-all term to try to say you're the apparatus around this woman who is selling sex.
The rest of the defendants are accused of intimidating women to become sex workers on Lucky's behalf.
And the reason Eunice Carter sees that as possibly the way in to bringing down this kingpin of the crime syndicate is because it shows conspiracy.
All the defendants are tried together in this conspiracy thanks to that Dewey Law, which he lobbied for and won, conveniently, just before the trial. Normally, in mob trials, the big boss is protected while the low-level players become the fall guy. This new law means people charged with 2 or more separate crimes could be tried under a single indictment, and that Dewey wouldn't have to spend taxpayer money on several separate expensive cases. Plus, the jury could see the big picture of how all these crimes were connected. And ultimately, the ringleader can be held directly accountable. As the judge finishes reading out the charges, Lucky has a view directly across the courtroom.
At the other table stands Thomas Dewey, smug and confident.
Dewey starts his opening statement. He says that Lucky Luciano is a prostitution overlord, a menace to society. And then he turns to what he must know will be his most vulnerable area to attack during the trial, his witnesses. Frankly, my witnesses are prostitutes, madams, heels, pimps, and ex-convicts. Many of them have been in jail. Others are about to go to jail. Some were told that they would be prosecuted if they did not tell the truth. I wish to call to your attention that these are the only witnesses we could possibly have brought here. We can't get bishops to testify in a case involving prostitution. And this combination was not run under arc lights in Madison Square Garden. We have to use the testimony of bad men to convict other bad men. And with that, it's the defense's turn.
They had some pretty high-level criminal lawyers working for them.
Lucky's lawyer is a prominent Long Island criminal defense attorney, George Martin Levy, who hasn't had the same kind of preparation Dewey's team has enjoyed.
On the Friday before the trial began on Monday, Moses Polakoff, who was Luciano's lawyer, called George Martin Levy and said, "Would you take it on? We need a trial lawyer of impeccable reputation." And Levy said, "How long would I have to prepare?" And Polakoff said, "The trial starts Monday." And Levy took it anyway.
In his opening statement, Levy argues that the government's tactics are underhanded. Their evidence is shaky. And the link to his client, Lucky Luciano, it's even shakier. By the time George Martin Levy finishes speaking, the battle lines for the trial are clear. Could Lucky be directly linked to Vice? As Lucky looks across at the other co-defendants, he must have been a little worried.
Clearly, his co-defendants, the people who were running this prostitution bonding racket, were guilty.
Lucky's presence in court alongside them is one of the most damaging weapons the prosecution has.
The bookers, the bondsmen, the middle management types, the hold-up men, the strong-arm men, the evidence against them was overwhelming.
But this association alone isn't enough to sink Lucky.
Question was, could they prove that Lucky Luciano, personally, was profiting from the earnings of prostitutes?
The prosecution needs evidence of that connection. And what they have are their witnesses.
Many of these women were drug addicts, had other mental or emotional challenges. A lot of that was so looked down upon in 1936.
Fortunately for the prosecution, the judge is going to help them out a bit there.
Judge McCook made a big point at the beginning of the trial to tell the jury some of the witnesses that you were going to be hearing from are from very different circumstances than you. Because some of these women did sign deals of immunity if they were willing to testify against Luciano. There was, for the general public, this belief on the part of many that, you know, well, these women will just make any kind of deal to get out of whatever they're trying to get out of.
Whether the prosecution could prove that Lucky himself is the big dog of this whole racket would come down to witnesses' testimony. Eunice Carter herself has spent hours interrogating and preparing women like Nancy Presser.
There was this grave concern that even if their stories were airtight, even if they stood up to hours of cross-examination, could you really take their word for it?
But once again, Judge McCook comes to the aid of the prosecution. At the start of the trial, he makes an extraordinary ruling.
Ruling that hearsay testimony was admissible.
Hearsay testimony, when someone in a legal case tries to prove a fact by repeating what someone else said outside of the courtroom, rather than providing direct evidence of what they personally saw or experienced.
That was how all of these women were able to testify. So it was a real stretch.
Stretch or not, the prosecution still has precious few witnesses who are prepared to point the finger at Lucky. So even with hearsay testimony permitted, as the court broke for that first day, the prosecution of Lucky Luciano is on thin ice.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
As the trial of the century progresses, Lucky's resting bitch face deepens and begins to crack. Lucky sits in the dock alongside defendants and hears witness after witness link him to the charges of compulsory prostitution with hearsay. And now it's time for Nancy Presser to get on the witness stand.
Nancy Press's testimony enraged Lucky Luciano because she claimed she was his girlfriend and that she had spent time with him in the Waldorf Astoria.
Nancy tells the courtroom she's known Lucky for the past 3 years. She links him directly to the vice rackets. And she claims to have heard him say things like, "Madams will have to bond, and if they refuse, wreck their joints." But the problem for Nancy comes when she's cross-examined. Unsurprisingly, the recollections of a sleep-deprived woman with a heroin addiction and withdrawal are a little inconsistent. And Levy is quick to put Nancy under more pressure. Like, surely a man of Lucky's alleged criminal stature would choose to hook up with a more glamorous type of woman.
He liked showgirls. He liked beautiful women. He liked women of stature. And he didn't like being associated with somebody who was a drug addict and the girlfriend of Ralph the Pimp.
Then Levy goes in for the kill. He starts asking Nancy for the kind of details someone would know about a former boyfriend. What sort of bed do you sleep in together? What's the layout of that luxury apartment? Does Lucky have any distinguishing marks? Nancy stumbled. She doesn't seem to know. Backed into a corner, she responds with stories of how Lucky is impotent. And that's why she can't provide more intimate details. Nancy Presser has ovaries of steel. I cannot imagine. One, testifying against the alleged boss of all mob bosses, and two, putting into public record in front of other mob guys that he can't even get it up. Whew. Her cross-examination lasts well into the evening. Nancy pleads to the judge that she's feeling ill. She needs to step aside. But even that doesn't stop Levy's interrogation. Eventually, her cross-examination does come to an end, but only after the defense introduces into evidence the floor plans of the Waldorf Astoria, which clearly contradicts Nancy's descriptions of her supposed boyfriend's crib. If she'd been able to participate that day, I imagine Eunice herself might have admired that very specific, detail-oriented attack. Despite Nancy's disastrous testimony, Dewey's team still has a number of other witnesses.
Some of these women held pretty high positions in the vice ring.
But as these women come and go,
there wasn't very much evidence at all against Luciano directly.
With the exception of Nancy Presser, all of these women were able to testify that they heard someone discussing it.
Is the case against Lucky falling apart? A few days into the trial, and across town from the courthouse, a woman sits in a Manhattan prison, the Women's House of Detention. If you took a stroll down Greenwich Avenue, you'd be forgiven for confusing the women's house of detention for a block of apartments. Opened in 1932, it's 12 stories high, with reddish-brown brick on the lower floors and fading yellow brick at the top. It's not immediately obvious that the stylish Art Deco building is, at that very moment, housing hundreds of the city's most criminalized women. But if you pay close attention, you'll begin to see this is no high-class apartment building. You can't see in through any of the many windows, and they're designed in such a way that makes them impossible to climb through. There's a roof garden where the inmates supposedly play miniature tennis, but it's caged in by wire mesh. When it first opened, the Women's House of Detention was an experiment with a new kind of prison system, one that prides itself on referring to its residents as inmates, not prisoners. The women had complete physical and psychological exams on arrival, and they're given uniforms of bright colors instead of the usual drab gray. And on Sunday mornings, they receive another change of clothes. I can appreciate the attempt at remembering that the people inside those walls are still human beings who should be treated as such, even if on the wrong side of the law. But some of the treatments sound pretty brutal, and that includes those for addiction, probably one of the main reasons women found themselves there in the first place. The prison hospital occupies the upper floor of the Women's House of Detention, and a few days after the trial of the century begins, one woman is facing an ordeal. Her name is Florence Brown, but you might remember her better by one of her aliases, Cokie Flo.
She was smart, and she was a heroin addict. Back in those days, if you were an addict and you were arrested, you went through what they called the five-day cure. They administered smaller and smaller doses of heroin to you, or methadone, over the course of 5 days, and that was it. It was an agonizing process of going through drug withdrawal.
After Cokie left her family home and fell in with the mob in Chicago, she moved to New York and then into sex work.
Cokie Flo, she's in a category all her own.
But that night in February, when Eunice and Dewey's meticulously executed raids shook the city,
Cokie Flo was not arrested. She went into hiding, basically. She attempted to get clean. She went through rehab.
But a little over 3 months later, in May of 1936,
she either wanted the money or she got bored or she went back on heroin, whatever it was. For whatever reason, she then got arrested for propositioning an undercover police officer. And so she was arrested for prostitution while the trial was going on. And she was thrown into the Women's House of Detention.
And while she's there, going through the pain of withdrawal, someone points out to her that there was this trial all over the news. Maybe it can be her ticket out.
And she was in the throes of that five-day process when girls whom she knew who were being held in the Women's House of Detention basically said, Flo, you were Jimmy Frederick's girlfriend. Dewey's people would love to talk to you. And you could probably make yourself a nice deal.
Jimmy Fredericks is a mob enforcer and an associate of Lucky's. He's also one of Lucky's co-defendants. Which means Cokie has been spending quite a bit of time in the company of the mobsters at the heart of the trial. And now, Cokie realizes she has a get-out-of-jail-free card up her sleeve.
Did she make a deal for her testimony? You bet.
Maybe it isn't quite a get-out-of-jail-free card. She still has to testify in open court against a bunch of mobsters. But even that comes with some perks.
If you cooperated with Dewey, you went to a hotel and got wined and dined, taken out for drinks, taken to the movies. If you wouldn't cooperate, you stayed in the Women's House of Detention.
Rooftop miniature tennis and a change of outfit on Sundays aside, I know which one I'd choose. So, in the middle of heroin withdrawal, Cokie Flo agrees to testify. And when she does, it causes quite the sensation.
Cokie Flo was considered a material witness, a witness whose testimony is crucial to the case.
On Friday, May 22nd, Cokie arrives in court. Her testimony is tough to witness. She's still recovering from her five-day cure and experiencing brutal withdrawal symptoms.
Her testimony was pretty rugged, and they would drag her off the witness stand. Can we take 5 minutes, Your Honor? Sure. And then they would ply her with brandy or whiskey. This was their idea of a cure. And then she was right back on the witness stand.
I'm no lawyer, but is that ethical or even moral to allow such an incapacitated person to testify?
A standard question in any legal proceeding in the United States is the following. Are you under the influence of any drugs or alcohol that would influence your testimony today? Another question is, have you taken any drugs or alcohol within the last 24 hours?
It's up to Judge McCook to determine if Cokie Flo's testimony is admissible. And after hearing from doctors from the defense and the prosecution on whether she is fit to stand trial, maybe unsurprisingly, he decides she is.
Judge McCook made some rather interesting decisions. He allowed things that should not have been allowed. Her medical condition was not questioned, nor was the fact that she was being laced up on breaks. If McCook had wanted to challenge that, he could have ruled right then and there.
Cokie's testimony changes everything.
She claimed that she could attest to 5 different meetings that she attended with her boyfriend, Jimmy Fredericks, with Lucky Luciano, where they discussed the prostitution. So she was the key witness in the case. She was the one person who could testify to the fact that Luciano was the head of this prostitution bonding combination.
And it isn't just the jury whose minds are changed by the testimony.
It wasn't until Cokie Flo really put Luciano in the frame that he felt he had to go on the stand to defend himself.
Lucky is about to have his say.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
When Lucky finally takes the stand on June 3rd, 1936, there can be no denying he's undergone some kind of major transformation. From street urchin to a Waldorf Astoria address, even in court, as he sits through testimony that could change his life yet again, he projects luxury and comfort. He is the gangster version of the American dream. He traded in his hand-me-down bootstraps for fine Italian leather loafers. But Dewey wants jurors to see the flecks of blood on those custom-made tassels. Dewey hopes that when Lucky opens his mouth, everyone will see past the silk suits and remember how he got them. Once a hoodlum, always a hoodlum. Dewey wants Lucky on the stand. And Lucky, he's pretty confident he can convince folks he's just as respectable as the rest of them. Which is probably why he ignores his lawyer's pleas not to get on the stand.
George Martin Levy, his lawyer, strenuously told him not to do it.
A slip of the tongue in the heat of the moment is all it takes.
Luciano insisted. His attitude was, I have nothing to be ashamed of in connection with this prostitution case. I had nothing to do with prostitution. It's all a big setup. The witnesses are lying. I want to go on the stand and tell them the truth.
Luciano had that wow factor. When he walked into a room, he was one of those types of people that everybody goes, wow, who is that guy? They're drawn to him. But if you were trying to pick the best witness, he is not it.
He never should have taken the stand. Over the course of 2 days, Dewey viciously cross-examined him.
Dewey throws as much gangster spaghetti at the wall as he can.
He cross-examined him about having lied to get a gun permit, income tax fraud he'd committed, various mob connections he had.
And Luciano would usually respond the proper way of no, no, or yes, which frustrated Dewey.
The testimony stretches into the next day, with Dewey trying his best to get under Lucky's skin.
There was a moment of levity when Dewey was cross-examining him about the time he'd been arrested with a shotgun and some handguns and a bunch of ammunition in the trunk of his car.
And the policeman says, what are you doing?
And Luciano tried to say, come back from a hunting trip upstate New York.
The policeman asks, what were you hunting? And Luciano says,
peasants. He meant to say pheasants, but he said peasants.
Dewey reads the transcript of this mistake aloud while Lucky sits stone-faced in the witness box.
And the courtroom erupted in laughter.
What was the point of it? To make Luciano even more upset and look like an uneducated Italian immigrant. That's what the prosecution needed, was to make these guys look like dregs of humanity, a parasite on society.
Dewey needs this moment, not only to shake Lucky by having people laugh at him, but to highlight that no matter how many gold watches he has, Lucky is still an ignorant thug who needs to take advantage of others to get ahead. And Dewey knows this kind of anecdote can go well beyond the courtroom.
This becomes fodder for every newspaper covering this trial.
Dewey the showman, always keeping the press entertained. The reporters make sure the public knows this gang-busting crusader is landing his punches in court against America's so-called most dangerous gangster. Dewey lays the trap for Lucky, and Lucky walks right on in.
As cool and collected as Luciano is in the mob world, Dewey has his number. He ends up incriminating himself, stumbles over words, makes himself look, dare I say, uneducated, because he's led into verbal traps that Dewey sets for him.
There was something about his arrogance and his attitude on the witness stand that didn't fly well. And it was reported in the tabloids for what it was, you know, back talk.
Lucky may look refined with all the obvious markers of wealth, but it isn't enough. He thinks he knows the rules. Make the money, wear the right clothes, live in the right places, and you'll be accepted. He ignores the most important part. It's how you make the money. You have to earn it the right way. You have to be born with it. Gold watches are fine, but they're looking for the silver spoon in your mouth. By the time Lucky steps down from the stand, it's June 4th, and the trial is near its conclusion. Lucky's testimony has been a disaster.
What they are able to do is get into the jury's mind the fact that he clearly knows every single one of his 12 co-defendants who they have actively connected to prostitution.
But still, those witnesses.
It's possible that the spectators and the jury had really been prejudiced beyond belief by seeing the condition of some of these prostitutes and how vulnerable they appeared on the witness stand.
And the fact remains that Dewey has failed to produce the one crucial bit of evidence against Lucky.
In all of his hours of questioning and cross-examination, they are never able to actively, concretely connect him to the prostitution racket.
By the time Dewey finishes his closing argument, at a little after 6:15 in the evening of June 6th, the verdict against Lucky still seems up in the air. And now the jury has to decide. The judge spends a full 3 hours with the jury before they file out of the courtroom. Over 1,000 people have turned up to wait outside the courthouse. Spectators crowd the street. They've probably consumed weeks of relentless reporting. They're waiting to hear what the verdict will be. And what about Dewey? You might think that he'd head straight back to the Woolworth building to give an update to Eunice and the rest of the team, right? Wrong. He goes up to the deserted judge's dining area in the courthouse, takes off his tie, his jacket, and his waistcoat, stretches out on a sofa, and sleeps peacefully for 5 hours. What a team player. The following day, early morning on June 7th, things outside the courthouse reach a fever pitch. The jury has reached its decision. The court clerk addresses the jury and asks,
"Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon a verdict? Do you find the defendant, Luciano, guilty or not guilty?"
The jurors agree. All defendants are guilty.
Shock ripples out from the courtroom and across America.
Luciano is convicted on 62 charges of compulsory prostitution.
But for Eunice Carter, Thomas Dewey would not have been able to convict Lucky Luciano of compulsory prostitution. Eunice Carter's idea and her ability to persuade Thomas Dewey to pursue this route, I don't know that Luciano would ever have been convicted of anything.
Does Dewey even think of Eunice at all during the conviction? I doubt it. He's probably thinking about his next move, which is exactly what Lucky's defense team is doing. They're already preparing for an appeal.
It was a rickety case that Dewey built against Luciano.
And it turns out, they had pretty good grounds for reevaluating the story they'd heard in court. And not just about the witnesses, but about Lucky himself. Is he even really the boss of bosses?
The narrative was good guys versus bad guys. That doesn't come close to describing organized crime. The idea that organized crime was centralized and hierarchical doesn't stand up to scrutiny. There's a better story to be told, a more complex story.
If Lucky isn't the big bad wolf Dewey made him out to be, then who is? Is the case Eunice Carter built about to crumble under close scrutiny? That's coming up in episode 7 of The Godmother. You've been listening to...
I'm Debbie Applegate. I'm a historian and biographer, and I am the author of Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the jazz age.
My name is Christian Cipollini, and I am an organized crime historian and author.
My name is Chuck Greaves. Before becoming a writer, I spent 25 years as a Los Angeles trial lawyer. My fourth novel was basically a fictionalization of the famous 1936 Vice trial in which Lucky Luciano was prosecuted by Thomas Dewey.
Hi, my name is Ellen Paulson.
I research and I write books about women who were involved with notorious gangsters and desperados.
I am Claire White, and I am the Director of Education at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas.
I'm Mike Woodiwiss, author of Organized Crime and American Power, a teacher at the University of West of England.
The Godmother is produced by Novel for iHeartRadio. For more from Novel, visit novel.audio. The Godmother is hosted and written by me, Nicole Perkins. Our producer is Leona Hamid. Additional production from Adjua Jima Brimpong, Ronald Young Jr., and Zayana Yusuf. Our editor is Adjua Jima Brimpong. Additional story editing from Max O'Brien and Mithali Rao. And our researcher is Zayana Yusuf. Additional research from Mohammed Ahmed. David Waters is our executive producer. Field production by Tanita Romani and Palace Shaw. Sound design, mixing, and scoring by Nicholas Alexander and Daniel Kempson. Our score was written, performed, and recorded by Jeff Parker. Music supervision by Nicholas Alexander and David Waters. Production management and endless patience from Cherie Houston, Sarah Tobin, and Charlotte Wolf. Fact-checking by Findle Fulton and Danya Suleiman. Story development by Madeline Parr, Jess Swinburne, and Zayana Yusuf. Willard Foxton is our creative director of development. Special thanks to Leah Carter, Stephen Carter, Angela J. Davis, Andrew Fernley, Marilyn Greenwald, Sandra Lebedy, Catherine Godfrey, Nadia Mady, Amalia Sortland, Sean Glenn, Neil Krishnan, Julia Bromberg, Katrina Norvell, Carly Frankel, and all the team at WME.
Novel.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.